Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. I'm glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show, we'll be returning to a subject that we have talked about before here on the show, and that is the state of the nation's pension systems. In the past, we've concentrated mostly on pension issues involving people who work for private corporations. This morning, we want to look at something a little bit different, and that is to talk about public pensions, public employee pensions. There are something like 2,300 public employee pension plans in the United States. They provide benefits to 15 million state and local government workers. And while many of these pension plans are in good shape financially, others are in crisis. And it has been estimated, and sort of depends on who you ask, that the funding gap here could be, anything between $300 billion and $700 billion. And the state of Illinois has the distinction of having the most underfunded pension system in the country, with an unfunded liability of $38 billion. And certainly that's a significant issue for the state government of Illinois, but it's also an issue for many other states as well. We'll talk a little bit this morning generally about what's going on with public pensions and also specifically here what's going on in the state of Illinois. And we have two guests. Both of them have been on this program before. Fred Gertz is professor of economics. He's also affiliated with the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at University of Illinois. He specializes in state and local taxation issues, also regional economic development issues, among other things. Jeff Brown is associate professor of finance, also here at University of Illinois, and among the things he's interested in, pensions and Social Security. So as we talk, questions are welcome, and I know that they'll do their best to deal with questions that might come in here from people who are listening. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to ask as a kind of a general question here, and maybe I'd ask Jeff Brown, you can respond, if Fred can too, if he wants, to talk in a national sort of a sense. We have a lot of different employee pension plans at the local level, at the state level. It covers a lot of people. If I ask a kind of general question about how they're doing, particularly how many, this ratio of those that, as far as we know, are in good shape and those that aren't, how serious a problem is underfunding in public employee pension plans?
Well, there's no doubt it's a serious problem. I mean, as you mentioned, there are over 2,000 state and local pension plans in the U.S. About 125 of those are large state pension plans, like the CSRS system here or the state teacher system here in Illinois. And then there are thousands of other smaller municipal plans. As you mentioned, sort of the official statistics on these are that they are in aggregate underfunded by on the order of $300 billion. And then Barclays Global Investors, which is a big money management firm, has actually estimated that if you did the pension accounting for public sector public sector plans in the same way that we do the accounting for private sector plans, that's where you get up into numbers on order of $700 billion. We're to the point in many of these plans where the funding obligation that faces the state is in many ways larger than an annual state budget. Mm-hmm. You mentioned in the state of Illinois, it's not quite to that level. We have about a $38 billion hole that needs to be filled to bring our pension plans up to full funding. Our annual budget, including the capital piece of the state budget, is hovering around $50 billion, according to the latest budget. So these are very big numbers. And going forward, they're only going to continue to get worse and form a even larger drain on the scarce resources that states have. So there's no doubt that something's going to have to give here, either on the benefit side or on the tax side. And, of course, there are a lot of political and, in some cases, like here in Illinois, legal restrictions on the ability to do very much on the benefit side. Yeah. So it is a serious problem.
Well, let me turn to Fred Gertz and ask you if maybe you can talk a little bit about how, here specifically in Illinois, how this problem has come about, particularly how it's happened over time, as I'm assuming that was there a time when the plan was fully funded, or has there always been something?
It's always been less than fully funded. Let me add something to Jeff's statement, maybe to allay some of the fears of our listeners, that when we're talking about the pension problem and the looming issues that we face. I view it more as a state budget problem as opposed to a problem that is going to be faced by annuitants or people close to being retired, because the state does have, in fact, a legal and constitutional obligation to pay the benefits. And the question is how they're paid. So it's more of a crisis for the taxpayer as compared to a crisis for people who are retired or close to retirement. There are also some issues for new employees, because there has been a reduction in benefits for new employees, but that's a longer-term kind of issue. Your question, though, was about the history of funding in Illinois. And Illinois has always, at least as far as I know, for several decades, been underfunding its pensions. This has not been an accidental occurrence. It's been done expressly to free up resources for other things. So basically, we've used a kind of de facto borrowing from the pension contributions to use for other purposes, schools and roads and things of that sort, not so much roads, but schools and other kinds of public programs. So over the years, the budget time comes, the state legislature, the General Assembly, and the governor face an issue. We want to spend a lot of money. We want to do a lot of good things. Do we want to raise taxes? No. Where can the money come from? Well, it can come from underfunding the pensions. And that was done for years and years and years. It was recognized that this was leading to a major kind of problem. In 1995, there was a major bill that addressed the issue over a very long term, over a 50-year term, and said we want to get well by 50 years from now. And they had a schedule that we're supposed to follow to do that. They didn't want to do anything precipitously, so they decided not to really endure any pain for about 10 years. So the first 10 years of the recovery actually was getting worse rather than better. But then eventually in 2005 and after, state contributions were ratcheted up fairly substantially. And if that had been had continued, then eventually the if the assumptions were borne out, we would have gotten back to full funding or 90% funding after several decades. But 2005 came, it involved substantial contributions to the pension system. Governor Blagojevich and the General Assembly blinked, and they basically reneged on their promise and set out a new system where the pain, again, is several years out into the future. So it's like always having a balloon mortgage, and when the balloon comes, always refinancing and never actually paying the principal. So politically, we haven't been able to step up and meet the obligation. And the state does have the obligation. They're not bonds that we have to pay, but they are obligations that are constitutionally mandated to our retirees, and they have to be paid. If the pension systems have no money in the system, no investment accounts, it has to be paid directly out of tax money. So it is a problem more for taxpayers than it is for retirees or public employees.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me raise a question that have I think some people have raised in talking about these funding gaps. They say something like, well, when you come up with these big numbers, what we're doing is not only are we considering current obligations, we're also considering future obligations, and saying that we don't have the money in the bank, all of the money that we would need to pay not only next year's and the year after that, but out. And I think some people would say, well, it doesn't matter that we don't have all that money in the bank today, because we don't have to be paying it out today. That's when we say that we're underfunded by $38 billion. That's a huge number. But how critical is that number really?
Well, it's an important number, because it says that if we were to sort of blow the whistle and stop things today and pay the benefits we already are obligated to do, it would take $38 billion more than we have to do that. So we're not including the future benefits that people earn when they work in future years. So it's basically as of today. So it is a real number, but there are different ways to do it. The state could choose to do it like the Social Security system and do a pay-as-you-go system. There's nothing illegal about that. It would be much more expensive. We'd end up paying about 20% of payrolls for a pay-as-you-go system compared to a pre-funded one of about 10% of payrolls. But if the state chooses to go that direction, which they have in sort of a de facto way, it can be done, but it's going to be more expensive.
Yeah, I was just going to add to that a couple of points. First of all, as far as why we got into the situation in the first place, I mean, I agree very much with Fred that the lack of sort of political will to fund the system over the last 30 years has contributed in a big piece. But related to this point is that unlike private plans, where there is a requirement to actually pre-fund the benefits, there is no such requirement that binds on state and local governments. So as he just alluded to, The state actually has some flexibility here to determine whether they want to fund it entirely on a pay-as-you-go basis like Social Security or whether they want to fund it like a private pension plan. But it's important to realize that those obligations are very real. And in particular, they are even more real in the state of Illinois than many corporate plan are because of this constitutional guarantee. This is essentially as if we had issued $38 billion of debt and that we are now legally obligated to pay that debt. It's not necessarily a short-term cash flow problem. We don't have to come up with that $38 billion in the next year or the next 5 years. But that is money that we are obligated to eventually pay back. Mm. And what we've been doing over the last several decades cumulatively is not only not making good on that debt, not paying that debt down, we're actually adding to it because we're not even keeping up with our annual obligations. It's as if we're not even paying the interest on our debt, and we're just letting that accumulate. And eventually, we're going to have to pay it. And the sooner that we do that, then the more options we have later for addressing it.
Let me just quickly introduce again our guests for anyone who might have tuned in. Last person you heard here is Jeff Brown. He's Associate Professor of Finance here at the University of Illinois. Also with us is Fred Gertz. He's an economist. He's also affiliated with the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. And we're talking about public pensions generally and also specifically applying to the state of Illinois. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think as Jeff Brown just mentioned, there is no federal law that says anything about the rules under which the state or city pension plans work. Just this past summer, because of concern about public sector pensions, Congress passed and the president signed a law that says to private corporations, you've got to fully fund your pension plans, and it gave them a number of years to get to 100% funding. But there's nothing like that, and even though there seems to be concern in the Congress about this issue, it seems to me kind of unlikely that Congress would pass a law that said to states, for example, you also must fully fund your pensions.
Yeah, well, Congress actually passed that law to protect the federal government. It wasn't so much to protect the employees whose pension systems were at risk, but they were liable through the Pension Guarantee Corporation to fund at least a portion of the pensions that were not met by the private sector. So it was a way of controlling federal costs. So the state, if they're prudent, should take action to do that at the state level, but they haven't. There's something that economists call a moral hazard problem, where people aren't necessarily going to consider the consequence of their actions. And with the pension, with the non-impairment clause, which guarantees pension payments, it encourages people not to take very seriously this unfunded liability. So, for example, if someone asked me, would you rather have a pay raise this year or better funding for the pension system, I'm going to choose the pay raise, knowing that eventually the pension system is going to have to be funded by the state sometime, somewhere, someplace. And that's true with unions. It's true, for example, if you ask the University of Illinois administration, would you rather have X number of dollars for the University of Illinois to spend for programs, or would you rather have that X go to funding the pension system? They're going to choose having to go to the state, to the university to do things, the good things they want to do, knowing that eventually the pensions will have to be paid anyway.
That's a great point. I mean, I fully agree that this is a taxpayer problem, and part of the problem is the taxpayer has very little voice in any of this. The boards of directors of the various retirement systems or the boards of trustees are required by law. They have a fiduciary responsibility to look out for the best interests of the participants in that plan, not the taxpayer. The various employers and employee groups obviously have a certain set of incentives. So unless the governor and or the legislature is out there looking out for the interest of the taxpayer, there's really no formal mechanism for that voice to be heard elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And it's relatively easy to continue to put this problem off.
Well, there was in August some members of Congress held a hearing in Springfield on this issue to talk about it. And they said, well, it was appropriate and important for us to be doing this because, after all, it affects our – there was a member from Illinois. They said, well, after all, this affects our constituents. It should be something that we're concerned about. But having said that, is there really any role here for the federal government in this?
I don't think so. I mean, there's a long tradition of leaving to the states the things that are the states. And, you know, we have a federal system that respects state rights in certain areas. And clearly how the states choose to compensate their employees and the contracts that they make with their employees is something that I think Congress would be very, very loath to reconsider.
Yeah, I actually testified at that hearing, and it was a good hearing, an interesting hearing. But the allegation from the Blagojevich administration was it was staged for political purposes. It was a Republican from Minnesota plus Congressman Biggert from Illinois who held the hearing in Springfield to draw attention to the pension system. So for once, maybe, and rarely, the administration may have been correct in their appraisal of the rationale for that.
I want to go back and underscore a point that Fred, you made a little bit earlier, because whenever we talk about this issue, I'm sure that people who are in these systems get nervous because they start to think, well, does that mean that when it comes time for me to retire, I might not get the benefits that I'm expecting? And you made the point, and we want to make it again, that the Constitution, as far as Illinois is concerned, the Constitution of the state of Illinois says that the benefits will be paid. So then the question becomes, when it comes time to pay them, where does the state go to get the money? Is it, though, I just want to make sure that there's no way for the state of Illinois, not to renege completely, but to say, somehow reduce the benefits or find some way to make it so that they have to pay out less.
But short of a constitutional amendment, I think that's not likely or very unlikely. The one area, though, where this assurance is not as strong is with post-retirement health care benefits for employees. People now who retire under the state systems are entitled to very good health care benefits. But those are not considered a pension benefit. They're not pre-funded. They're actually funded on a pay-as-you-go basis. And the state, the only guarantee about that is a political power that retirees would have or workers would have to do that. So there's no guarantee for post-retirement health care benefits, while there is a very strong guarantee for the actual money payments in retirement. Mm.
I would actually say, though, that there are some ways, they're small and they're subtle, that the state can actually affect people's retirement benefits. And an example of this happened as of, I think, July 1st of last year, which is take the CSRS system that covers state university employees. If a person is in the traditional plan, which is the only one that existed prior to around 98 or 99, in which the vast majority of university employees are still in, your benefit at retirement is calculated under the better of two different approaches. You either have a traditional formula that takes your years of salary and your years of service, your final salary, and so forth, and computes a benefit. And then they also have a money purchase option. And that money purchase option essentially acts as if you have an account that's growing at an interest rate. And that interest rate used to be set by the CSRS board. Well, starting about a year ago, the power to set that interest rate was taken from the CSRS board and given to the state controller, who has begun a process of lowering that interest rate. Well, that's going to have the effect of essentially lowering, or at least having a possibility of reducing, the retirement income that people will get under the plan. Now, there's only so big an effect that it can have. And I actually believe that might actually be the right policy. But it certainly is a way in which the pension funding has had a direct effect on some people's benefit levels.
Hmm. Well, I'd argue, though, that could go either way, that there was a slight reduction from 8.5% to 8% in the findings of the controller. But eventually, it's going to become known to the taxpayer and also – not taxpayer, but to the annuitants, and also known to the controller that he or she is going to control a future pension benefit. So there's going to be political pressure on the controller to be generous, maybe more so than on the CSRS board. So it could work either way. Right now it's working to moderate the benefits, but in the future it might go some other direction.
One of the things that when Jeff Brown has been here before, when we talked about what was going on in the private sector, one of the things that we have seen, one of the trends we have seen, is the move away from defined benefit plans, to the point now where I think we're looking at a point where probably most of the people under defined benefit plans are in fact public employees. We're going to see fewer and fewer of them in the private sector. Do you think, is there some chance, do you think, that in the future that state governments Or can they adapt that as a strategy to deal with their costs and, like the private sector, tell their employees, well, what we really want you to do is, you know, we'll set up a 401k or 403b or whatever it is, and essentially go that way and move away from defined benefit plans even for government employees.
Well, I think we are seeing this, although it's moving much more slowly in the public sector. Florida, a few years ago, undertook such a reform. Here in the state of Illinois, for the last 7 or 8 years, in the CSRS system, there is at least an option now to take an entirely self-managed plan. The advantage to those types of plans is that they are fully funded by definition, because the way a defined contribution plan works is that each year you just make a contribution to that plan on the employee's behalf, and then once you've made that contribution, the state's responsibility is done. That's actually a good thing for purposes of providing some security to the individual, for providing some fiscal discipline on the state because they have to come up with that money to pay. The difficulty, of course, is that if what the politicians are hoping to do is look for ways to avoid funding this so they can divert resources elsewhere, it makes it harder for them to do that. I know that Governor Schwarzenegger in California has been making an attempt to move in that direction there, has been meeting some fairly fierce resistance. So it's much harder to do in the public sector, in part because the politics are more difficult, the unions are much more active, and the unions traditionally are big supporters of the defined benefit system.
Right. Well, Illinois, even if they wanted to, they can't afford to do that now because the if we went to a defined contribution system, we'd have to make the full payment, as Jeff mentioned, every year for every employee. But we still have this overhang of past liabilities that still have to be paid off. So it would be a huge funding obligation for the state to go in that direction. If we had done it many years ago, it might have solved some of our problems. The other thing, which I think is a misunderstanding, that people almost immediately think that a defined contribution plan is necessarily less generous and worse for the employee than a defined benefit plan. And the only real difference is who bears the risk. Under a defined contribution plan, the employee bears the risk. Under a defined benefit plan, the employer. But there's no particular reason why one is more generous or less generous than the other. So sometimes private businesses will make a change and they'll reduce the size of the pension benefits at the same time they go from one to the other. But that's not necessarily a part of a defined contribution plan. It can be very generous if people choose to do it that way.
Well, that would be something, though. Just again, if say for example, we decided to do that in the state of Illinois, really it would take some time because we'd have to all of the people who are under the existing plan, we'd have to sort of work them through the system, and then we'd say, okay, we'll start today. Any new hires, we're going to put you into this new plan, and then eventually we're going to get to the point where we'll work all the older people out of there, and then the younger people will be in the new plan, and we would have crept slowly from one to the other.
As Fred pointed out, though, that is easy to do if you're starting with a defined benefit plan, which is already fully funded. The difficulty is that when you have this $38 billion overhang, that's not going to go away. And so you're going to need to fund the contributions to the defined contribution accounts and still service that $38 billion. And so it's much more difficult to do when you're starting off in a hole. And this is the same problem we have nationally with Social Security. Social Security is basically a 0% funded or very low funded plan. It's financed entirely on a pay-as-you-go basis. And that was the whole debate about transition costs when people talked about personal accounts, is that you have to simultaneously fund those and fund the old liabilities as well.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds as if, say, depending on where you are and what sort of unfunded liability you've got, that might be an option. But if you've got, as we said, if we've got this big gap already, the bigger the gap is, the harder it would be to make the change, and maybe the less likely it would be that you would even be able to think about doing it.
Right, and politically it's difficult because unions don't like it. I think unions are mistaken, especially in the private sector. Unions think that a defined benefit plan is more secure and so on, while a defined contribution plan is subject to the vicissitudes of the market. But the problem in the private sector is you have a huge default risk under a defined benefit plan, so that doesn't and sometimes less security with a defined benefit plan in the private sector is compared to a defined contribution.
Yeah, I would guess there are a lot of pilots from United Airlines whose union no longer believes that defined benefit plans are very safe. So I think that attitude may change over time.
Mm-hmm. Our guests in this part of Focus 580, Jeffrey Brown and Fred Gertz. Jeff Brown is Associate Professor of Finance at University of Illinois and, among other things, is interested in pensions and Social Security. And Fred Gertz is an economist, is also affiliated with the Institute of Government and Public Affairs and specializes, among other things, in issues of state and local taxation and this particular issue of pension issues here in the state of Illinois, something that he's been following for some time now.
Well, I also follow for a particular reason. I was on the CSRS board for 10 years.
That as well. And I suppose, you know, in the interest of full disclosure, I guess I would say we all have some vested interest in how this issue plays out, all three of us here, and I'm sure a lot of people who are listening. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Given the fact that, you know, there are powerful political groups in, say, in the state of Illinois and other states that are interested in this issue, why is it, I wonder, that that underfunding of the public pension hasn't somehow been more of a political issue? And certainly this year, it's an issue in the race for governor. That's not surprising. I'm sure people who are running for the legislature have something to say about it. But somehow it seems that it hasn't been a very high profile issue. I mean, and is that?
Well, I think it goes back to some of the things we talked about a little bit earlier that. No one wants to bear the pain early. They'd rather bear it late, and we're always deferring things. I've been using a quotation for some time now. It applies to a lot of things, including Social Security, but it's a quotation from St. Augustine, who was a saint back in the 3rd or 4th century, but he didn't become a saint until late in his life. So he said his prayer was, "Give me chastity and self-restraint, but not yet." And that's what people seem to be saying, give us fiscal restraint and let's do something about the pension system, but not yet. We still want to have the ability to spend our money for other things in the short term.
Hmm. So now is anything really likely to change anytime soon? And periodically we have these discussions, we have an election, it becomes an issue. It's a big number, but I'm not quite sure that we're really – It may just be the case that you just cite, that we say, yes, that's a problem, and one of these days, you know, we got to do something about that. But
Something's going to have to change. Either we're going to have to blink and renege again, or we're going to have to start paying. The 2005 revision of the pension, the state pension funding arrangement, basically grossly underfunded pensions for 2 or 3 years, which is the period we're in right now, and that freed up money for other things. But in a couple of years from now, the state's going to have a huge increase in pension contributions. It would be almost all of their natural increase in state revenue growth. So unless the state decides to spend every extra dollar they have for the next few years on pensions, nothing for schools, nothing for old people, nothing for Medicaid and so on, we're going to have to do something. And the two things we could do is either decide to step to the plate and find a way to fund it, or roll the clock back again and push the problems back into the future.
Hmm. Which do you think is the most likely?
Well, I don't know. I think that another option, too, is to change what some people call a soft debt, which, like Jeff alluded to, we don't have there's no piece of paper that says we owe $38 billion. It's just an obligation we have to pay. But what we could do is go out in the market and actually borrow money and put that into the pension system, then it would no longer become a pension problem. It would become a bond repayment problem. And a bond repayment problem is much, in a sense, easier to deal with politically than a pension problem.
But that keeps pushing the problem out.
No, but you have to start paying it. Once you issue the bonds, then you're obligated to pay the bonds on a fixed schedule. So it would make a kind of a hard choice about funding the pension system.
Well, I was going to say that whenever I start to get depressed about our legislatures or with Social Security, Congress's inability to act, I always recall Herb Stein's comment that if something can't go on forever, it won't. And we're not exactly sure how it's going to resolve. But what worries me is a couple of things. One is at the very time that our pension liabilities are going to be growing over time. I also do a lot of work on long-term care and Medicaid's role in financing long-term care, and the Congressional Budget Office expects that's going to triple over the next 30 or 40 years. And the states carry a big part of the burden for financing Medicaid. So when you look at Medicaid expenditures growing much faster than inflation and faster than the economy, you look at the pension liabilities growing more quickly, there are going to be some very hard decisions that are going to be made. And my concern actually is I do understand that there may be some value to converting this implicit debt into explicit debt and sort of forcing ourselves to therefore deal with it. On the other hand, I'm a little concerned that that's all we're going to do, that we're going to keep issuing pension obligation bonds that essentially just convert this liability from something we owe the pension plans to something that we owe the external debt markets, which are much less forgiving. And, you know, if we're not careful, we could end up putting the state into a not-so-admirable fiscal situation a few years down the road.
Yeah. There's a two rules that were suggested. Douglas Holtz-Aiken was the director of the Congressional Budget Office, stepped down about a year ago or so, and he was interviewed on C-SPAN when he was going out, and they said, what can we do about the Social Security situation? We have this terrible problem. He said, well, it's going to be solved basically for the Herb Stein reason, that if something can't go on forever, you have to do something about it. And the question was, well, what should be done? He said, well, I don't have an answer, but I have some things you should think about. And one is that any kind of change is going to inflict pain, and the pain should be probably widely spread. And the second is that all options should be on the table, that we should be able to consider a lot of different things. And if you set aside certain kind of things, say we can't touch this, we can't do that, we can't do this, the degree of flexibility is reduced considerably and makes it a much more difficult decision on the remaining options. Well, in the state of Illinois, we have, in fact, decided not to inflict pain. Governor Blagojevich said, I don't want to have any kind of burden on the working person. The average person should not have to pay more taxes. No one should have to bear any pain in that regard. And secondly, we've ruled out almost every option that is a possibility. The governor came into office saying, I won't raise the income tax. I won't raise the sales tax. That's fine. I won't cut education spending. I won't cut spending for public safety. I won't cut public spending for health care. So you take the three or four biggest expenditure items and say you're going to increase those. You take the two largest revenue items and say you're not going to increase those. There's virtually nothing left to do. So something has to give here, and I think that has to be a consideration for the next administration, whether it's Governor Blagojevich or someone else.
I agree. And another thing I think we have to be careful of are these what I consider to be political gimmicks. They can be done properly, but they're often not done that way in the political sphere, is selling off state assets and then treating those as a revenue stream when really it's just a one-time payment. So, you know, there's discussion of selling off the lottery or of selling off other state assets. And there's a sense in which that might be a good thing to do, but you shouldn't think of that as being able to take credit for that asset sale all in one year. You're giving up a stream of revenue in return for a short-term sum of money. And as long as you use that sum of money wisely and you spread it out over time, that might be a good thing to do. But, you know, you just can't go selling off all your assets to pay your current expenditures.
Well, we have some callers here we'd like to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. We'll take them in the order they came in, starting with someone here on line number one. Hello.
Is this Urbana?
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. I have to say, as a 73-year-old CSRS annuitant, I don't feel very lighthearted or philosophical about what's going on, because I see that, look at the scandal developing in the Blagojevich administration this morning. You know, one of his principal fundraisers, the principal advisors, has got his arm up to his shoulders in shaking down corporate interests. You know, how many Enrons do we need? How many financial scandals do we need to realize that we're kind of back in the golden age, you know, of the corporate malfeasance of the late 1800s, that everything is being played. It's got much money in it. Everything's being played by very large corporate interests. In energy, oil, real estate, you name it. If there are billions to be made, we've got these cynical, sharp, intelligent operators, and government is a resource, just like oil for these people. And they don't care that much. They've demonstrated over and over again that they don't care that much about the welfare of the general public. Now, as for the public getting aroused, gentlemen, that's really playing into, I think, one of the cheapest and most unreasonable kinds of assumptions about the apathetic public. When does a Kucinich or a real reformer get oxygen or funding, you know, in this day and age to counter a campaign by a Blagojevich? The system is now pretty well set up so that corporate interests rule the airways. You know, nobody left of center much is getting much airtime or much play. If press, media of all sorts are to be controlled by large corporate interests, why do we expect that the public is going to get that much information or that much propaganda to arouse them?
Well, let's get a comment here from
Well, yeah. I think you misinterpret the recent scandal. This is a scandal of the government exploiting businesses, not businesses exploiting the government. What the recent scandals about was using the pension fund to extort money or squeeze out money from various kinds of money managers who did not want to pay it. They were being forced to, or at least asked to pay to be able to participate. So this is not a case of big corporations impinging on the government. It's a case of the government or someone acting as if he were a member of the government trying to take advantage of the private sector.
I think you're taking too narrow a view. The fact is that there's money to be made in government work by someone. What's his name? The fellow that was Abramoff. It's just exactly the same thing. The shakedown can work either way.
Yeah, well, we're getting maybe a little far afield of the subject. I don't know if Jeff, you want to pick up on anything that the caller had to say.
Well, just on the issue of, he began the comment by saying that he was a 73-year-old and knew it and wasn't really feeling in the mood to be humored about this. And I think that's absolutely a fair position to be in. I mean, on the one hand, it is true that there is this state guarantee, this state constitutional guarantee in the form of the impairment clause that protects participants, not just annuitants, but current participants. But on the other hand, if you roll this forward enough decades, if the problem gets bad enough, you could suddenly start to imagine a situation where people realize the only way the state can get out of its crisis is to amend that constitution. Now, that's hard to do. Something like 5% of the residents of the state of Illinois are state and local employees or retirees. But, you know, I think he has every right to feel upset about the funding situation, but I think I'll withhold comment on the specifics of the current scandals.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Fred, is there anything else that you wanted to?
No, I think that discipline is lacking, and I'm not sure it's one part or the other. Both parties have been responsible in the past for lack of discipline. I would not be particularly comforted by Dennis Kucinich being in charge of my pension system either, so I'm not sure what the solution is.
Yeah, the one thing I will say for those folks that are participants in the CSRS system, which I'm most familiar with, is that while there is a problem with political will at the level of the state house and the legislature, the CSRS system itself is very well managed and is in good hands. There's an excellent board. The current executive director, Dan Slack, is doing a terrific job. So at least at that level, once the assets actually find their way to the CSRS system, they're in very good hands. It's the question of how do we get those assets to the system in the first place, which is where the problem is.
We just have about 10 minutes left. We have a couple of other callers who I want to get to. I hope the caller will forgive me for wanting to go on. And also, very quickly, I should introduce again our guests. Jeffrey Brown is Associate Professor of Finance, and Fred Gertz is Professor of Economics. He's also affiliated with the Institute of Government and Public Affairs here at U of I. Questions, welcome. Here we're talking about public pension issues, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And our next caller up here is on line number 2, is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? Mm-hmm. as I listen to you guys talk about the numbers involved, the political will, and all this stuff, but I was going to ask you a question in reference to, I've listened to this subject for many years, and I've noticed that there's almost two parallel tracks of information going along here. You have all these monies coming in, money spent out, money's being held in reserve for payments to people in retirement. And then you have, this is going to sound like an odd thing to say, but then you have things like the National Institute of Health, the CDC, and all these medical organizations and Harvard medical studies who say that the population of the United States, let's just stick to the United States, is 40-50% very much overweight and very unhealthy, which would incur early demises, you know, dying before the age of, let's say, retirement, 65 to 70. So on your data points, do you guys, I know it's really difficult to say, well, if you're 50 pounds overweight, you won't live to be 70. Is there any sort of a way you can track that? Looking at the Harvard studies, particularly there was a Harvard study about a month ago that said the severity of the weight problem in the United States is going to really significantly curtail some of these people's lifespans. So is that factored in there like an actuarial table from an insurance company? Do you know anything about these data points?
Yeah. Well, let me say two things. First of all, CSRS and most of the state pension plans do use actuarial assumptions, which are sort of based on current best estimates. But the more general issue that you're raising, there is an ongoing and somewhat raging debate in the demography literature about whether the tremendous mortality improvements that we've seen over the last century are going to continue. In fact, there are two of the world's best-known demographers have a bet about whether life expectancy at birth is going to reach like age 100 or age 150 by a certain year. The payoff is a few hundred years in the future, and so they were able to bet hundreds of millions of dollars that only has a present value of a few thousand today. So there is tremendous uncertainty about this. The actuarial tables that are in use now do assume some mild level of continued mortality improvement over time. And my own reading of the literature is that I do think that life expectancies are going to continue to rise on net, but there is tremendous uncertainty about that. I don't think that the rising obesity epidemic is going to overcome all of our other medical and other technological improvements that are extending life.
Yeah, that's not going to reduce the pension liabilities. And there's an economic kind of argument that people substitute. So if you have statin drugs that allow you to lower your cholesterol and you have ways to deal with your high blood pressure, you can afford to be a little bit fatter than you otherwise would and still live longer. So there's kind of a trade-off that I don't think the obesity is going to swamp the other effects of better treatment, better ways of dealing with some of the problems.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, thanks.
All right. Let's go to Champaign County. Another caller here, line three. Hello.
Hi. The commonplaces that we hear about retirement, the Social Security crisis. Well, to WLL's credit, they've had people on that have said otherwise. Dean Baker and Mark Weiss brought Social Security, the phony crisis. And recently, I was looking for an economist that was interviewed recently, and he just dismisses the concern. He just says that productivity is expanding enough to make up for the, you know, this lower ratio of actual live worker. What that translates to is we just need to get more money out of corporate profits, which means a tax of some kind. But there really isn't a crisis in Social Security, but it's a commonplace that everyone accepts that there is. So, you know, retirement working for a public institution is a little removed from the direct productivity and productivity gains, et cetera. But what the point I'm trying to make is that we're given this crisis mentality, and I don't think it's accurate at all. But it does translate into needing to reallocate productivity gains from stock holders and corporate funds themselves to social goods. I don't know how you'll react to that.
Well, I particularly want to hear what Jeff Brown would have to say, seeing as he's on this presidential panel to look at issues in Social Security.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I just have to say that the premise of the question is just wrong. The Social Security forecasts, which are done either by the Congressional Budget Office or by the Social Security Office of the Chief Actuary, which are completely non-political and have complete buy-in from people on all sides of this debate. At least the respected academic policy experts in this area, people like Peter Diamond at MIT, who was a big opponent of the president's plan. Everyone sort of agrees on what the numbers are. And everyone agrees there's a problem. I don't like to use the word crisis. I've never used the word crisis because it's not an impending thing. But it is a long-term serious financial problem. These arguments that people make about how productivity growth will save us ignores the fact that if you look at the forecasts of the Social Security finances, it already includes in it productivity growth, which is on par with what we've seen over the last 7 or 8 decades in the United States. The problem that we have is that productivity is, you know, if productivity growth remains as strong as it has been historically in the U.S., and it has been quite strong, that is not enough to offset the massive demographic change we have, which is that people are living longer than ever. People are having fewer children, and so there are just more retirees and fewer workers. And they're in a pay-as-you-go system, that type of system cannot sustain itself. So it is a serious problem, and it does need to be addressed. And I think to deny that there is a problem really does future generations a disservice.
We're getting really short on time. I have another person I want to get, and I don't want to cut off Fred's. I'll give you a chance to say whatever you want to say. But because we've gotten into this subject of Social Security, because we've talked about this before with Jeff Brown, is anything – now, there's been talk about the problem on Capitol Hill. President Bush, when he was starting his second term, decided he was going to make that a major issue, made a lot of speeches, traveled around the country, and he didn't seem to be able to get people, Americans, very excited about this issue. Do you think that anything much in the way of Social Security reform or whatever you want to call it is going to happen anytime soon?
Well, it depends on what you mean by soon. It's certainly not going to happen in the next couple of years in this administration because the issue has become too politicized and there's too much political baggage between the current president and the Democrats on Capitol Hill. Most of the leading contenders for the party nominations for the presidency next time around understand that this is an issue that's not going to go away. And I think what we really – our best hope is that an individual gets in there that has some political goodwill on both sides of the aisle who can forge a true bipartisan solution. There actually are a large number of people on Capitol Hill as well as in the policy wonk circles who understand there's a real problem and that what we need is to put everything on the table, including taxes, including changes to benefits, possibly including personal accounts. And you know, if we get the right kind of person in there that can bring them together, I think we could see some action. If, though, in 2008 we have another bitterly divided close election and whoever from either party takes office comes in, you know, with a Congress on the other side and a lot of ill will, it's going to be extremely difficult to achieve.
All right. We'll try very quickly to get one more caller. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hi. Thanks
yes.
for the show. When they, for the money purchase formula, when they shifted the calculation for the effective interest rate to the state controller from the Service Board, now, if he set it at 8% this year, and say, for instance, the Service Board would have set it at 8.5%, so if they do that for 10 years, that's going to be a 5% difference reduction in a payout to me in a money purchase formula. That sounds like to me it would be illegal because it, you know, according to the state constitution, they can't reduce the benefit. That's one. And then how do we know that what the CERS board would have said it if they would have had still be setting it? How do we know if they would have set it this year at 8.5? On what basis do they set this?
Well, there actually are two calculations. There's the interest rate set for money purchase. There's also an internal rate set for a very technical reason for fairly obscure purposes that the CERS board still does. So there's still a rate chosen by the CERS board plus one chosen by the controller, and there is a difference. But I don't think the constitutional protection goes so far as to say it always has to be done the same way in the past. Now, the controller can go back and say, we made a mistake back in 2001 and lower it for that. But in future years, I think there's no recourse about arguing that it should be done by the surge board rather than the controller.
Well, but so is it possible, though, that Jeff Brown, you said earlier that this is a way that the benefit could be reduced by what they're doing.
Well, that's correct, but the effective interest rate which they are setting is not something that is established long in advance. It's set on a year-by-year basis, and so I am not a lawyer, but I would guess it would be extraordinarily difficult to make a case that whatever rate the controller set was lower than some hypothetical rate that would have been set by a different organization had they been setting it. I think that might be a very difficult thing to prove, so I'm not sure there's going to be good legal grounds.
Well, I think if you had a range like between 7.5 and 8.5 and people come out in different areas, there's not much to do. If the controller said 2%, then right. Presumably there would be some recourse in that case if it's outside the bounds of reasonable estimates.
I'm going to have to jump in here. My apologies again, but we're at the end of the time. I'm sure that we'll be getting back to these issues again, particularly social security. At some time in the future, I'm sure we'll be talking again about Social Security, perhaps other of these issues. But for the moment, we will have to close out this hour with our thanks to our guests, Fred Gertz. He's a professor of economics, and Jeff Brown, associate professor of finance, both here from the U of I. Thank you very much, both of you.
Thank you.